Thanks for coming to this talk, being so excited for reparations. Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Cool, can folks hear me still?
Yeah?
Okay. It's slightly ironic that the reparations debate has emerged in the last few months within the context of a purely reactionary, extremely racist, and misogynistic administration and general climate in the country. Mm. My most optimistic outlook of this is that it's a resultant of a presence of the struggle against anti-black racism haunting the psyche of the American working class in the backdrop of increasing racial inequality, the near absence of social safety nets, and the persistent lack of accountability for state-sponsored killings of black people. The fact that the debate about reparations is even able to reach the point where it is, where Congress is formally and seriously entertaining the idea of discussing what it would take to enact reparations for the generational crime of chattel slavery, illustrates the extent to which racism has become the central issue, unable to be dismissed by right-wing or centrist forces within the federal government. The increasing visibility of this debate also illustrates the extent to which there is an increasing openness to the idea among working class Americans, particularly among Generation Xers, Millennials, and Generation Zers, who are demanding we reckon with and repair the wrongs of this country. The detracting arguments from right-wingers and Republicans like Mitch McConnell is unsurprising. What's more shocking are the conclusions coming from some on the left, especially socialists. In a recent piece in The Guardian, recent like a few months ago, Jacobin founder and editor Bhaskar Sankara argues against reparations. His conclusion is that socialists, in particular, the idea that socialists ought to reject the framework of reparations because it, quote, can't adequately address racial inequality, can't be effectively administered, and there is no mass base of black Americans pushing for it. This is a preposterous and risk of obscuring the positive impacts that a reparations package will more than likely have on the entirety of the working class, as well as among working class and poor black people. As a socialist myself, I strongly disagree with this conclusion. At this point, the quote, moral case for reparations is undeniable. In a country built upon slave labor and the displacement and extermination of native peoples. To do so today exposes one's limited understanding of what white supremacy and anti-black racism is and how it has been deployed to terrorize, disenfranchise, and undermine black life. I also agree that reparations are clearly not sufficient to fully eliminate racism, or for that matter, racial capitalism. But the purpose of reparations is to make amends for wrongs in this case, and wrongs for wrongs, in this case, wrongs of chattel slavery, persistent racial inequality, and ongoing state-sanctioned terror offering the assistance through material means, and yes, money, to help right those wrongs. And while I strongly back universalist, redistributive programs that benefit the working class people at the expense of the rich, e.g. Like Medicare for all, free college tuition, a federal jobs guarantee, and so on. But for this universalist tide to lift the boats of black liberation, these programs have to include a concerted approach that not only expands access, but builds and rebuilds infrastructure in black communities, and that establishes independent and collective control over wealth and resources. Self-determination is still a desire of black people. And self-determination, political and economic independence, are not just theoretically relevant aspirations, but they have practical and pragmatic implications. Moreover, I agree that universal programs have significant anti-racist effects. For example, Medicare for All would disproportionately benefit Black people who are overrepresented among the ranks of the poor and working class. The massive federal investment that it would take to guarantee tuition, free education, or higher education in public institutions would be a huge boost for HBCUs, most of which are financially precarious due to decades of divestment and austerity. But for how long? History has shown us that under racial capitalism, freedoms won by struggles of ordinary, poor, and working class people are almost always rolled back, weakened, or erased altogether. So my question to Sankara then is simply, why can't we agree with all of these premises and also strongly back reparations? Or put differently, why not see Sankara's basic assumptions as supplying a strong case for reparations, not against? At this point, any opposition to H.R. 40 is baffling. H.R. 40 is an extremely modest bill that merely initiates a process to convene public hearings and form committees to collect information about atoning for slavery. So when Republicans argue that a reparations package will not be passed or that Black people have received reparations in the form of voting rights, and a Black president is laughable if it wasn't so damn insulting. Ask Black folks in Atlanta if they felt the good feeling of freedom when they voted last November, or couldn't vote. In Chicago, survivors of the John Birch torture machine still are denied freedom of movement, freedom of education, and even in some cases the freedom to purchase a car without having to check in with the state. Mm. When having your name on a list of suspected gang members without your knowledge can mean the difference between whether you are approved for a house, can get a job, or even obtain insurance, freedom becomes a tenuous thing. Regardless, H.R. 40 strikes me as something that socialists should support on principle without a second thought. After all, simply starting the conversation is the bare minimum. Whatever commission that is created from H.R. 40 has to develop a robust proposal for a reparations package. For that package to be robust and the most impactful for Black people, there will have to be some struggle from below. So why not start the conversation on something Sankara himself concedes is a moral necessity. So in response, Sankara says, we don't need more conversations or committees, we need action. By which he means action aimed at winning universalist demands like Medicare for All. But why counterpose these two? Again, why couldn't Bernie Sanders, for example, both back H.R. 40, which he has, and at the same time continue to argue forcibly for Medicare for All? He's doing that, and the sky hasn't fallen. So, reparations has been discussed in both broad and meticulous ways. For example, achieving a free college education doesn't root out racial discrimination in the admissions process. It removes the financial barrier to higher education. But anti-Black racism is not solely confined to the economics of a society. Following this example to its conclusion, reparations for higher education could include opening those institutions where Black people are, where they live, which would contribute to increased needs for to employ working people and not just as educators, although that would be great too. A similar argument can be made for the universal expansion of Medicare. Far from being counter to Sanders' basic political message, reparations fits into the central argument of that we need a quote political revolution against the billionaire class. After all, extremely wealthy, the extremely wealthy were the primary beneficiaries of the slave system. Most of the richest individuals in the United States, most of the richest individuals in the United States, on the eve of Civil War, were the owners of large southern plantations worked by slaves. And indeed, many of the members of the billionaire class today are beneficiaries of the slave system and its afterlives. One quick example. So billionaire J.P. Morgan Chase chief Jamie Dimon recently he attacked socialism as being a disaster that would lead to the corruption to corruption and favoritism. Now that's what came out of his mouth. Now there's plenty to say about the corrupt role that financial institutions play in profiting from a rigged economy and lobbying to purchase political influence in Washington. But we also must not forget that J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, one of the oldest and largest banks in the U.S., was directly involved in slavery. Skipping ahead, so why not demand that that the bank relinquish what was never its rightful property in the first place, namely wealth forcibly extracted from slaves. But what if this would mean forcing Chase to liquidate all of its assets and go belly up? My response is similar to that. An institution whose continued existence depends on clinging to dividends derived from exploiting and owning human beings doesn't deserve to exist. Pointing this out strengthens the left critique of the unjust power of financial institutions. So for the sake of time, I'm just going to skip ahead. Folks know that black folks and white folks organized together in the 18th century, it was relatively successful. These things are possible. And demanding reparations doesn't get in the way of that. The question for the left today is how to avoid continuing down the road that frustrates labor unity and makes impossible the formation of a united working class to revolt against the wealthy powers that be. The only way to do this is to jointly advance radical class-based demands and anti-racist demands at the same time in a way that emphasizes that they are mutually complementary rather than counterposed. Yeah. The potential for reparations to strengthen the working class cannot be denied, though, and should not be viewed as racially divisive impediment to genuine working class struggle. That is genuine working class struggle. Rather, it should be viewed as a politically sharp and strategically strengthening and strategic strengthening of the working class through a socioeconomic elevation of one section of the working class to a socioeconomic parity with the rest of the majority of the working class. How much time?
About 2 minutes.
I'll wrap up by this, and hopefully we can get into some of the other stuff in the discussion. So with this in mind, right? Sankara's concern about who would and who would not be permitted to benefit from reparations seems less justifiable than these questions to some extent put the cart before the horse. Moreover, given the reality that slavery transcends national boundaries and formed a key part of the development of global capitalist economy, it's unclear at first pass why we should exclude the possibility that black immigrants from Africa or the West Indies, to borrow Sankara's example, might be rightfully included among the beneficiaries of whatever form of reparations eventually takes. Neither should we assume that reckoning with the legacy of slavery precludes reckoning with the longstanding historical injustices, such as the atrocities committed against Native people. In the Trump era, when toxic forms of nationalism are on the rise in the United States, socialists must be very careful not to advance their demands in ways that reproduce the very divisions between native-born and foreigner that we aim to dismantle. Whatever the course, a public reckoning with racialized chattel slavery ultimately takes, however, there will be poor and marginalized groups who will not be eligible for reparations. It could hardly be otherwise, given that not everyone is descended from the people who were forced to live their lives in chains. This need not be seen as a drawback, however. After all, reparations is only meant to address one specific problem, not all the problems of social injustice, which require other remedies, all of which we staunchly support, and we should staunchly support, and are committed to fight for. In that regard, reparations is about a society coming to terms with its racist history and doing what is necessary to repair that damage. The demand for reparations for the crimes of slavery coming from a political left that refuses to separate economic demands from social demands is engaging in a holistic approach to fighting racism that encompasses both a socio-political and material process for societal transformation. So I refuse to counterpose reparations and broad class-based measures that aim to tax the wealthiest 1% and meet the needs of all poor and working people. And as a socialist, I don't believe that anyone should be forced to go without Medicare when they need it, forego education for lack of money, or struggle to make ends meet because this society refuses to offer them meaningful, gainful employment. Contrary to centrists, like I would argue Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, they're not actually progressive, who reject socialism, I don't think that the rhetoric of reparations should be thought of as a substitute for an alternative to these sorts of measures. Rather, it should be seen as a necessary supplement to them, and also as something that has moral and political importance of its own in a country that was built on the backs of slaves.
Great job, Todd. Thank you so much. And as introduced already, I want to first suggest some books for you all, and I'll reference them throughout. And then I also have a pretty extensive list of things that a few platforms have put together, so I'll describe that. And then I'm hoping that we can talk about some of them more in depth during the discussion aspect, so it will seem a little bit more like a list right now, and then just generally discuss some of the, I guess we'll call it unrest or discourse or debate over this issue, and why it's been a debate, you know, and hasn't really been any action or tangible results, as most people would say, in a few centuries. So the first book that I wanted to bring up, and then I also am curious to see if people have read this book, or if you kind of heard of it, you can do like this. Have you guys read The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Okay, there's only about 10 people. Okay. And so that book, everyone, it's a must. Please don't leave here and not put it in your cart right now. Just do it now. And so it's The Color of Law, How the Government Segregated America. And I'll talk about that in just a bit. And then same things anyone read or heard of, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment for Black America, okay, three-ish people, all right, four. And what about Democracy in Chains, the deep history of the radical, okay, how the radical, okay, oh, that's interesting. All right, so that one has the most kind ofs and people that have read that. So I just say that just to frame my topic today. Typically, we talk about these things as, you know, kind of far-reaching and, well, let's talk about it first and let's do a study and all of that's fair-ish. It's fair, sort of, except it's been a few decades, as Todd said, since H.R. 40 was first introduced. And I don't know of any complete studies or final recommendations that we have from our government, let alone an implementation plan and a timeline. So we're moving very slowly on this, and my call to action today is for the people really to lead this movement. And just as an example, if we think back to some of the Occupy Wall Street and Democracy Now! Type of initiatives where people literally sat in congressmen's office, they blocked off streets, they demanded things, they had a very organized platform of here's the problem and this is what we need to do and here's what we're going to do and not do until we get those things. And we need to be just as organized, if not more organized, today. Because essentially what's happened is a discussion that's just drawn on without any true results. And what that means is there are people who are continually suffering and things are actually not getting better, they're getting worse. And that's what a lot of those books will discuss. So I just want to read a highlight. This is a report that was published. It's the Black Youth Project 100. It's the agenda to build Black futures. And I just want to read a segment from that. So during the period between 2007 and 2011, Black America saw its greatest loss of wealth in more than 25 years. In 2010, the average white household wealth was 20 times that of the average Black household, nearly double in the previous years. This is according to the Pew Research Center. The foreclosure crisis represented the largest transfer of property ownership out of Black hands since the Reconstruction. And I'm gonna say that again. The foreclosure crisis represented the largest transfer of property ownership out of Black's hands since Reconstruction. Reconstruction, 1860s. And so here we are in 2019, where we haven't seen those crises addressed. We can even go back and talk about specific instances that have happened. Just think of Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Harvey and what those responses have been and how those communities continue to suffer, and compound that on top of all of the economic shifts that we've seen. I'm not going to do the Bernie Sanders stump speech. I'm sure we've heard it, and how wealth is being transferred to the certain population of our wealthiest. And so we all know that. In fact, there's a new meme that I like, where it shows three billionaires and the names of the three billionaires and how they have literally more than half of America's wealth, these three people. And so that didn't happen. It wasn't like that 10 years ago. There weren't the same names on this list. So this is what's happening within over a decade. And if we're not moving quickly and swiftly to address it, things are only going to get worse. It doesn't help that we're the little people at the bottom, the working class, without the funds. What we have is community and we have power. And so that's going to be our strength moving this debate forward. So just to go back to the list. So there's a different couple categories, and then I added, so you may hear things that seem repetitive, but that means just that they came from a different platform. And so first, divesting from the prison industrial complex. Easier said than done, but literally divesting. As we saw, I don't want to give them any props, a particular bank that said, we will no longer support these private detention centers. And that was just last week or a week or two ago. And so that's the type of pressure that we need to put on the funds, companies with the money and the people with the money. Because as long as these projects are funded and people just make small waves here and there in different pockets of the country, that is not a large enough movement to create any type of sustainable change. And so ending fines for petty crimes and misdemeanors, this is something we've seen, again, Philadelphia, you know, St. Louis County, parts, different boroughs of New York. And so this, again, is a smaller movement where it supports those type of actions in other places, but again, this has got to be a real concerted effort. divesting public education funds from the prison industrial complex, which is more specific. Instead of fueling the school to prison pipeline and using third grade reading level scores to determine how many jail cells need to be built, we should actually be investing that into resources, you know, school counselors, books, teachers, those kind of things. Reducing police budgets and reallocating funds to the people. And just a caveat on that part is that the people is broad, right? So what does that mean? What does that look like? Where exactly do the funds go and where are they coming from? And that requires us as people to have a vision. And so that's what I'm hoping that we can all do today. Some other things that typically don't sound like reparations, but if we think about them as the whole person and the whole aspect, universal pre-K, fully funded and quality public schools, full access to reproductive health care, accountability for predatory lending. This is going back to some of the things in the color of law. So it doesn't mean as much to say, here's a clean slate. One particular recommendation that I'll mention from the color of law, just in the back, is that he said we should, the homes that were black people were declined, unable to rent, if you moved in, they'd bomb you and run you out. Those types of homes, whatever they were being sold for decades ago, if they were $20,000 homes then, it should be $20,000 homes now. And that's really the only way to address it. To give someone a $200,000, $250,000 loan is not really the same as, this is where your family should have been able to live. We're sorry that we declined that to you. Here's the price of that home now. Let's go back to what it would have cost you then. More things on that, accessibility to financial literacy. That's going back to the aspects of schools. Intentional support for first-time home buyers, not a pamphlet or a website or a program that you go to for an hour, but intentional, dedicated support. And that's not just support moving in, that supports retaining and keeping your home for decades so that it can become intergenerational wealth and not just, oh, I bought a home and then I lost it in the Great Recession. Supports for community land trusts, making sure that communities can begin to build that wealth and less grants and less asking, less fundraising, and being able to have this sustainable wealth that can last and is only going to grow over a course of time. Restoring voting rights to those who have been incarcerated, those on parole, those on probation, those still under the supervisory systems, millions of people who fall into those categories. And there's two states, as you guys may know, that allow people to vote in prison. They are coincidentally the most white states in the nation. That's Maine and Vermont. And there are many other states where there are high populations, and there are some states that do take away voting rights forever. And that's a myth that continues to spread that all states are like that. It's actually only about four states where that's permanent. And as we saw in the Florida referendum, some of those things have begun to change. And those are the type of things that, first, just to harp on that a little bit, it was a victory. And then it was a victory that got snatched back and an asterisk added onto it. And then for those who aren't super aware, restoring voting rights to, I want to say 1.5 million people, and then saying, well, unless you committed these crimes, or if you have any debt, you know, while you were in jail, we were charging you, you know, just a small $40 a day for your 15-year prison sentence. And now you need to actually give us that money back before we can restore your voting rights. We're so sorry. Anyway, so access to free and higher education. And some say public, I say all. Public education and private education should be accessible to everyone. It shouldn't be a limit onto where you can go. That's still limiting people by their income and by their geographical regions and by their family legacy. And so that's a barrier that we want to eliminate. Obviously stopping mass incarceration in the school to prison pipeline, again, things easier said than done, but these are just some of the steps that we can take to get there. Another thing that's been happening recently is affirmative actions under attack. So there needs to be an improved defense of affirmative action policies. The Supreme Court has made very narrow decisions over the course of decades, and there isn't actually anything protecting it. If the new case that goes up, the Harvard Law School, and there's actually two other lawsuits that people don't talk about as much, the Leaf University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and the university that is escaping me right now. But there's actually three different lawsuits all on the same issue, all pushed forward by the same plaintiffs. And it's only at Harvard where they've said that it's Asian students, so that one got a lot of attention. But there are actually similar lawsuits popping up all over the country, and so that's another one of those areas. If we're not organized, then we will fall behind. And as we see now with reproductive rights, something can get snatched away very easily if we are not organized. And just to go back to that book that I mentioned about democracy and change, there's a very detailed platform of how they, she's calling radical right, so not just the right, the very, very far right have been organizing, having conferences, raising millions, billions of dollars, foundations, they do speakers, they have certain universities that are affiliated with the organization. They have speakers come on campuses, and there are entire new generations coming out of, with their college degrees with certain information in their backpacks, and the left is not doing that. I'm very appreciative of conferences like this. I'm glad you all are here in this room. But there's definitely more organizing, more work to be done on our end. Speaking a little bit more on education, so public resources for the non-traditional routes, such as the trades, educational programming that is hosted by community groups. Communities know what they need the most, and so communities should be in front of those type of educational programs. Eliminating inherently racist standardized tests, mandating anti-racist training for all teachers, faculty, and staff, creating incentives for people of color who are educators with plans to retain them and not just hire diversity, but keep your diversity, and then holistic freedom schools that are rooted in community values. In terms of health and environment, we need to eliminate food deserts in Black and brown communities, access to free psychological and emotional trauma, a lot of which is associated with racism and post-traumatic slave syndrome and all of those characteristics. And so really just wanted to focus on some of those things. What does it look like to divest from the police? What does it really look like to invest in our communities? How can we come together in a way that is cohesive, in a way that is substantive? How can we become just as organized as those on the right? And the one other thing that I just wanted to highlight is applying pressure, strengthening the demands, utilizing the people. We often underestimate ourselves, and we don't realize just how much people power we do have. There's literally more of us in this situation than not. And so really what it takes, and what I hope we can do today with the reparations discussion, is to get on the same page. A lot of the unrest stems from, well, it wasn't me, it wasn't my ancestors, or how do you know that your ancestors, and what about people from Jamaica, or what about people who were born here, what about people from Africa, who came from Africa and weren't born in the United States? All of those questions, which some are good questions and they're worth discussing, it's also to be understood, to go back to what Todd said, what the irony that we're having this conversation now in the midst of the Trump administration, in the midst of a conservative Supreme Court, in the midst of all of the things that we haven't been able to get done that are, I would say, much more common sense legislation. How do we feel that a reparations discussion will go now in this climate? I don't know if it will go very well if we're not organized with a cohesive plan to get it done and to ask for clear cut demands and a method to get there. So I'm hoping that that's what we can do today. And thank you so much for your time.
Hello everyone. Hi. My name is Aislinn. I apologize for walking in late. So I'm also I'm not sure if this was included in the intro, but I'm also the co-executive director of the Chicago Torture Justice Center, which was a part of which was birthed out of the reparations ordinance, which was passed here in Chicago in 2015. And I'm gonna begin with a quote from Edward Baptiste, who is the author of the half has never been told slavery and the making of American capitalism. He writes, Oka Tubby, a part Chicta, part African teenager, enslaved in Natchez, remembered his first time under what they call in the South the overseer's whip. Tubby stood up for the first few blood-cutting strokes, but then he fell down and passed out. He woke up vomiting. They were still beating him. He slipped into darkness again. Baptiste goes on to explain. Neither their contemporaries then nor historians since have used torture to describe the violence applied by enslavers. Some historians have called lashings discipline to correct lazy subordinates. Even white abolitionist critics of slavery and their heirs among the ranks of historians were reluctant to say that it was torture to beat a bound victim with a weapon until the victim bled profusely, did what was wanted, or both. Perhaps one unspoken reason why many have been so reluctant to apply the term torture to slavery is that even though they denied slavery's economic dynamism, they knew that slavery on the cotton frontier made a lot of product. No one was willing, in other words, to admit that they lived in an economy whose bottom gear was torture. I include that to preface my talk and the reason why I was asked to talk about the Chicago reparations win. But I use that specific quote to preface my talk in discussing imagining using the Chicago reparations win as an example for what reparations for the transatlantic slave trade could look like, because slavery in its essence was a form of torture, and we don't conceptualize it in that way. We don't use that language popularly when we discuss slavery. When we talk about the consequences, the violence that was a necessary and vital component to forcing people held in bondage to work for free. That's what it was. How many people here are familiar with John Birch? Okay. I know Flint is. So for people who are not familiar with John Birch, I'll just give you a quick synopsis. John Birch was a former Chicago police commander who tortured the accounts that we have official records for, and Flint will correct me if I'm wrong, at least 120 primarily black men, boys, Latinx men, boys, but primarily black. We know that the full number is much larger than that. We know that women were also part of who was tortured. And we know that the way that gender violence is invisibilized and erased, people who come forward are often struggle with the multitude levels of oppression that contribute to their silence. And so the number of known women survivors we don't know. We're still discovering that. But we know, what we do know, is that over 120 people were tortured by John Birch and his torturing, which began in the early 70s. John Birch was a fighter in the Vietnam War and in the Korean conflict. He learned torture techniques while in Vietnam and implemented them. Part of the torture techniques that he used included a black box, which was called the nigger box, which was a box that had cattle prongs, and it was used often on people's genitals. There's a torture survivor at the center who was one of the first to win, to have his conviction overturned. His doctor asked him how many heart attacks had he experienced. And he said, I haven't experienced any heart attacks. And the doctor told him that the condition of his heart emulated that of a person who experienced 5 heart attacks. So the consequences of the torture on individuals' bodies is immense, and we're still learning the full breadth of what that means in survivors' lives. Burge led the torture, which is a key thing to remember. He led the torture, which means that there were other people also complicit. And the crew that he famously toured around the South and West Sides was known as the Midnight Crew. And they tortured many, many others. There's a fallacy that because we won the reparations ordinance in Chicago, and this has been something that is convenient for, you know, the powers that be, that somehow torture ended with Burge, and that when Burge was fired, when Burge was convicted of perjury because the statute of limitations on torture had expired, that somehow that had ended this shameful period. We know that that's not true. We know that Burge is one person, and that there are others who are engaged in, if not the same, equally violent and brutal and abusive methods of human rights violations against people. So there are all of these other officers who have never been convicted, never been held accountable, either still exist on the force or have retired. What we know, though, is that Holman Square sits out in the open today on Chicago's west side. And we know that, per the Guardian's coverage, that at least 7,000 people between the years of 2004 and 2014 were disappeared or held incommunicado. We know that the two cops who just got off from killing Joshua Beal in Mount Greenwood, one of the cops was coming from Holman Square. So the brutality that still exists within CPD extends far beyond just one person. And we still need to fight for the complete abolition of the entire Chicago Police Department. Part of how the reparations ordinance came to be was because of the extreme dissatisfaction that survivors and attorneys and family members felt once Burge was finally convicted by our court system and was given 4.5 years for lying under oath. People felt like that was more than a slap in the face, and that the fact that he was the only one, and that was seen as some symbolic measure of justice for the hundreds of people who survived and for the people who did not survive, seemed woefully inadequate. So out of that came an exhibit which imagined what would reparations look like. And in that exhibit, Joey Mogul, who works with Flint at the People's Law Office, imagined up, partly inspired by Standish Willis, who's another attorney and was a part of Black People Against Torture, the reparations ordinance, and thought, oh, this is just a dream. This will never pass. This is just a fantastical, you know, thing that I'm going to submit as part of this exhibition in exploring and imagining and strengthening our, you know, removing the boundaries of what we believe is possible. So she submitted this, and everyone loved it and rallied around it and said, let's actually do this. And so people began organizing. The Chicago Torture Justice Memorials began organizing around getting the ordinance passed through City Hall. And then a unique thing happened in the country, where Uprising, the new iteration of the Black Freedom Movement, began to gain more ground. We had Ferguson Uprising, we had Baltimore Uprising, we had uprisings happening all over. We had the Movement for Black Lives increasing its demands and increasing its presence in the streets here in Chicago. We had We Charge Genocide, which Todd and I were a part of, and Todd went to Geneva charging CPD with torture. We had this historic resurgence of momentum that we hadn't seen for decades. And within that context, Rahm Emanuel also was facing a very, very tough re-election. The video of Laquan McDonald was finally released after a lawsuit forced the city to release it. And the political crisis that was created resulted in Rahm Emanuel facing the very likelihood that he was not going to be reelected. And so through the brilliance of the organizers, as a part of We Charge Genocide, including Miriam Kaba, who I have to shout out, recognized this unique political weakness that Rahm Emanuel was in. And he was forced into a runoff, which was the first time a Chicago mayor had been forced into a runoff in 48 years at that point. And we did a targeted campaign, which included often daily actions, train takeovers, zines, teach-ins around the city, multiple pushes, propaganda campaigns to educate the public on reparations. And on May 6, 2015, Chicago became the first and currently only city in this country to ever win reparations for survivors of police torture. And what made this particularly special was that it did include monetary compensation, but it didn't only include monetary compensation. It also included four other key elements, which was the mandatory teaching of the CPD torture ring in Chicago public schools in all eighth and sophomore year classes. It granted free access to all the city colleges for all torture survivors and their family members. It mandated the creation of a public memorial so that the systemic invisibilization that is routine part of our system cannot occur. That has yet to be fulfilled. Rahm Emanuel rejected the funding for that, but the reparations ordinance includes that in that, so we're still fighting for that. And lastly, it included the creation of a therapeutic center on the south side so that survivors could go to the center and begin to recover from the psychological and social consequences of torture. And that is what birthed the Chicago Torture Justice Center, of which I'm the co-director of. Those five things in and of themselves are extraordinary. And there's nothing preventing the use of that template to be replicated across the country in terms of survivors of other forms of police violence and police terror and police torture, including survivors of police violence, terror, and torture here in Chicago who are not covered under the specific ordinance. And we are actually in talks about expanding it because, as we know, many other people have also experienced torture and survived and torture at the hands of CPD and continue to experience violence at the hands of CPD. This is a model that shows that once we provide space for expanding and thinking beyond the confines of what currently exists, of expanding what is possible beyond the confines of the current power structure and the current paradigms, that we can begin to imagine and then put that into concrete, real wins for our people. I want to just underscore what the speaker before me talked about in terms of education. It's really hard to separate out any institution that was not impacted by the massive profits of slavery, but particularly the U.S. college system was particularly funded by slavery. And so I just want to quote Craig Stephen Wilder of MIT, who says, "The story of the American college is largely the story of the rise of the slave economy in the Atlantic world." He goes on to say, Yale inherited a small slave plantation in Rhode Island that it used to fund its first graduate programs and its first scholarships. It is indisputable that the modern American educational systems, both public and private, have direct links to the economic spoils of the slave system, as well as the use of free labor that was forced out of the human bondage of millions of people of African descent. So at minimum, one of the things that without a doubt is a right of every descendant of the transatlantic slave trade is access to every single educational institution in this country. But further, and this is where I always struggle when discussing reparations, we have to talk about the destruction of U.S. capitalism.
You can have a little extra time.
And at its core, the system that was funded on the proceeds of the blood, the sweat, the lives, and the futures of descendants of the transatlantic slave trade means that what we put in place has to also still be held accountable to the financing that produced that. And so when I think about reparations, I do think about reparations before and after revolution. Mm. Yeah.